I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's Clash. So the suburbs were a darkly funny setting in the burbs on Monday, but today they're just dark as Tim Robbins' homegrown terrorist lures a hapless Jeff Bridges into his murderous web. From 1999, we're taking a trip down Arlington Road.
I've got a possible name change. The death certificate, what does it say?
He's changed his name.
To the name of a person who died the day before?
Yeah, why?
You do it to hide the person you were.
Hi, neighbor. His name is Oliver Lang.
I didn't know you taught a course in terrorism. Like, well, that's a pretty frightening subject.
It deals with extremist groups.
Seems he got one everywhere.
Are you listening
Your
to me?
Your neighbor is a terrorist that has been blowing up buildings.
There is a blueprint in his house he does not want me to see.
We'll have a winner at the end of the show, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Butters. Where's my son? Where's Grant? Where is he? I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
How are you both?
Excellent.
Really well.
Yeah?
Stressed by that. This is such a stressful... I can't believe you picked that bit.
I thought I'd pick that bit because this... it's a stressful movie.
So stressful.
I know I asked you on Monday why you'd picked this pairing, but Arlington Road is a big movie for you, isn't it?
It's massive! Yeah, it's really huge. Shall I just tell you?
Yeah.
So, right. Back in the day when I was at Goldsmiths, I wrote an essay about Arlington Road, but I can't remember why. So this is, I know it's really bad. So I did about 10,000 words on Arlington Road, and I also did the same on the net. So back in the day, I was linking films long before any of this bullshit came along.
Nice.
It turns out. You're welcome. But the thing is, I just genuinely have no idea why.
You don't have to be on this podcast.
This don't bullshit. Tie, Chris.
Oh, can you believe
bullshit.
I know. It's not like you're making any money from it.
So I just don't know. I don't know what came first. Did I see it and I was like, I want to write about it? Or did I think I was trying to find a reason or what someone suggested? I have no idea. But then I thought, so I did the timeline, I might just be, which would be weird, but possible, a Mark Pellington super fan, because at the same time I was working at the Odeon in Leicester Square and I've seen the Mothman Prophecies over 15 times. So I just spent this portion of my life picking up old Maltesers after the Mothman Prophecies and watching Arlington Road. And I've seen Arlington Road for this essay of 10 to 15 times easily.
Wow.
It's madness.
Did you not say it was, did you not, you think it's like almost the perfect script?
Yeah, I do. Right. Yeah, I do think that.
Yeah.
Because it just reels you in. And then, and also, but it's a popcorn film. I'm not saying it's like, it's going to like turn any heads at award season.
How's
but,
that fence you're sitting on?
I just mean, for a popcorn thriller, it's fucking brilliant.
Right.
And you can't deny that. You can't. Do you not like it?
I didn't say that. Saving it for the verdict, Chris. Saving it for the verdict. Now, I've just really put two and two together.
What?
Because I looked up Mark Pellington and I was like, oh, the Mothman Prophecies. Mm. I remember going to the Odeon in Leicester Square to see that and being
dropping food on the floor.
I was the only person in the screening room. And I'm wondering whether you let me in for free.
Sat behind you. I used to sit at the top and read and do work for
but we
college.
Knew each other when the Mothman Prophecies so came out.
Would it have been weird to sit next to you, just me and you, and just be like, enjoy the movie? Like,
but we know each other in this situation.
Yeah, we know each other, but then... So I must have let you in for free, but don't say that, I'll get fired. Like, well, that's let people in for free.
Were you not?
No.
they had to tell you that, though.
Look, the thing is, if you went to see the Mothman Prophecies at the Odeon Leicester Square, I was there, 100%.
Wow, that's crazy, yeah. It was playing in one of the smaller rooms up top.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, oh, that's so weird. I thought I was the only person in the room, but then I did hear a rustling at the back, which is probably you.
Me eating the old Maltesers.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not joking.
It's a terrible film, though.
I can't remember much about it, but I didn't like it.
No, it's not good. It's not good. Okay, so very quickly, before we get into the Mothman Prophecies, no, Arlington Road, if you haven't subscribed to us, please do on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you can, do leave us a rating and a review. And if you do leave a review, it might get read out on the show by Chris Tilley, a.k.a. Chris Thrilly, which sounds a bit like this.
There's some Kylo Zen.
Oh, I saw this.
Yeah. Something interesting going on here. So he says... One of my new favourite pods. Love the premise of this and the chemistry between the three is brilliant. Can't wait for more! ! Then he's done an edit. So I think that was an old review.
Yeah.
And he's gone in and I didn't know you could edit your own reviews.
Yeah, I didn't either, but you can because I've seen it elsewhere. But yeah, this is he's updated his review. When he was one of the very first people about 2 years ago, or they were one of the very first people.
Yeah.
To write a review.
And the edit says, still one of my favourite podcasts. I've spent so many hours listening to some of my favourite films pitted against each other and learning things I didn't realise or seeing films from different perspectives. Must listen to for any film fan or any fan of just good, intelligent and funny banter. Mm-hmm. So thank you for being our first double reviewer.
Yeah.
Intelligent over there, Victoria.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And funny over here.
Oh, great. Yeah. Chris, what'd you do?
Good. Good was the third word.
So on Monday, I had your back on the cul-de-sac. And today, Chris Tilley is stealing your child and worse in Arlington Road. Chris takes on a journey.
Arlington Road revolves around a brave patriot who plans to punish government for their corrupt actions. But his neighbour, who is battling his own demons, wants to put a stop to that plan. Their ideological opposition puts them on a collision course, which threatens to turn proceedings dark. But then the film has a happy ending, with our hero framing said neighbour, blowing up the baddies and making America great again.
Wow. Careful, honestly.
Yeah, you see, I know you said on Monday, you're not going to like my intro. You were right. That's it's worrying. And done with such conviction.
I'm just having a bit of fun.
He's having a bit of fun. I don't think he really believes that.
So it's funny, Vicky, you said just now that this script wasn't going to turn any heads during award season, because how this all kicked off was this script won an award.
Right.
It won the Nicol Fellowship from the Academy.
Such a long way of saying you're wrong.
Yeah, that's fine. I can take
it. It won the Nicol Fellowship from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
Wow.
So that is the biggest screenwriting prize.
Wow.
The previous winners include Finding Forrester, Mean Creek, Short Term 12, and weirdly, Season of the Witch.
I love that movie.
Do you?
The Nick Cage movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Do you?
Man, I could watch Nick Cage doing anything. This is exactly the kind of Nick Cage movie I want, where someone's gone, Nick Cage is still making big movies. Let's spend a lot of money on the production of this movie. It looks expensive.
Well, we'll talk after, because there's a film I want to pair and it would pair well with that.
Oh my God, what is it?
Let's not talk about it now.
Fine. But yeah, if you've seen Season of the Witch, Victoria.
No.
Oh!
I'd like it.
Yeah, if you've watched The Mothman Prophecies 15 times, you can make space for Season of the Witch. Yeah.
So Aaron Kruger wrote the script, and the thinking behind that award is you can only win it if you haven't had anything produced yet.
Right, okay.
Which is amazing, because he did go on to have a huge career. He wrote two Ring movies, he wrote three Transformers movies, and he has the new Top Gun movie coming out soon.
Brilliant.
So yeah, it won the award, which... generated interest.
Wish I hadn't used all the ink printing that information out. Look at that. There's three different colours of ink there. I printed out the whole Aaron Kruger, all his movies. And you can see the magenta's starting to fade. So ink's expensive for a printer. I should have just knew Chris was going to do that.
Apologies for doing my job.
It's all right. You're forgiven.
So director Mark Pellington read the script, liked it, and a bit like The Burbs, on Monday, he put together a deal quite quickly. The only real bit of interest, I think, behind the scenes here is Tim Robbins was the first actor hired, and he had trouble deciding which role he wanted to play. He was offered both roles. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm glad he picked the one he did.
Yeah, he said that he'd fancied doing a villain like that. And so he went for that, and contractually his name was supposed to be first in the credits and on the posters. But bless him, once Jeff Bridges was cast, he said, no, your name should go first. So you don't often hear that in Hollywood, where people insist on the other person having top billing.
You don't. But we'll talk. You were telling me earlier about another example of why it should be Jeff Bridges first in terms of the trailer.
Yes, indeed. And then they went through quite a long rehearsal period, which you don't normally get that opportunity on films. And Aaron Kruger sat in with them on the rehearsals, recorded all the improvisation they did around his script, and then completely rewrote the script based on the actors and what they brought to the table.
That's great. I mean, I know they do that. Well, the best people do that for TV a lot, sitcoms especially. I remember watching some roundtable reads of Blackadder, which the whole thing was just rewritten, watching Baldrick and Tony Robinson and Hugh Laurie and Rowan Atkinson just improvise around the script.
And in this instance, it was, I think the Brooke character is the one that changed the most, played by Hope Davis, because she said none of them could figure out who that character was when they read the script, including Erin Kruger. He was like, I've not nailed this one. And so they developed that character and gave her a bit more.
That's interesting, because I think she's still underserved and the weak link in this film.
Interesting. And that's all I've got on the background to this one.
Or you're not excited about one piece of news, Victoria? Who knows whether it's...
about the TV show.
Yeah. They're in talks to develop a TV show for the new Paramount streaming service, Paramount Plus. This comes from April this year. This was announced, and it is Pellington is set to direct the potential series.
Okay.
Yeah, the guy that did The Alienist is co-executive. Alienist is really good. I could see this working.
Have you watched both seasons? I've watched the first.
I only watched the first season.
Yeah, I watched the first one.
I liked it.
Yeah,
not enough to watch the second season.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same. Kind of feel the same. It felt like it should have been a season long, like a limited series. Yeah. And that'll do. But no, I mean, I'm saying that without seeing the second season, so I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see, because obviously a lot's changed in the world since Arlington Road came out. So
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see what direction they go in.
I will say this. I mean, I know you're a fan of Arlington Road. Roger Ebert, the critic, says Arlington Road is a thriller that contains ideas. Any movie with ideas is likely to attract audiences who have ideas of their own. But to think for a second about the logic of this plot is fatal.
Well, I see what he's saying.
I agree with him.
But there is another argument, isn't there? We'll get into it. There's a lot of coincidences, but maybe it's all on purpose.
I wrote that down.
Less coincidence to me, but I've written the word convenient more often than I've ever written that word before in terms of...
We'll get there, but the reason why I think the script is so good is you're fed on a certain like track. You're encouraged to think one thing and then encouraged to think another, often in the same scene. And that's very clever because normally you would like sandwich those scenes, wouldn't you? He's up to something. He's not up to something. He is up to something. And there's a really good scene that we'll talk about later with the kids where that's a great example.
Just for the record, because I wasn't asked today for some reason, but my history with this movie is...
Were you sat behind me?
I was on my own in the Odeon cinema. it was weird watching it again because I've definitely seen it and I remember the end and being absolutely, no pun intended,
maybe
blown away
told me
by
to
the
watch
end.
It because I've, like I said, I genuinely have seen it like 15 times, put it on in the week. I was like, Mark, we're going to watch Arlington Road again. He's like, what do you mean again? I was like, do you remember when I wrote that essay and I did the net as well? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So then I got worried that maybe I've dreamt the whole thing. It's none of it's real. He swears blind he hasn't seen this film. So who did I watch it 15 times with?
Don't know, but what time are you home for dinner tonight?
I mean, I haven't said my history with it either, but I think it was a poor choice of words from Alex saying he was blown away by the end.
but
I agree. I'm exactly the same. Watched it on video and thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because of that ending.
Genuinely. And I've not seen anything like it. I couldn't believe it. It was one of the few times when my jaw was on the floor and I was just like, what have I just...
Yes.
That cannot be the ending.
Yeah. I love a twist and I love being duped.
Yeah.
And this duped me.
It's brutal.
Effectively.
There's this and Seven, which are the two movies where you just sort of go, oh, fuck, and it stays with you. I can't believe they don't do this more.
And I think what's interesting about it here is it works thematically as well because Jeff Bridges is playing a character who's only seeing what he wants to see.
Yes.
And that's where he goes wrong. And as an audience, we're doing the same thing. We're falling into the same trap.
Yeah.
By buying that we're watching this action movie hero at the end.
But also, Jeff Bridges' character is about, that's why the scene where, so first of all, when he's teaching, he's like, look out, terrorists are everywhere. You know, the government say that they're not, but they're everywhere. That's basically what he's saying to the class. Like, there is the sort of sleeper cell kind of thing. Then later when he's talking about his wife, he's like, the flags went up for the wrong reason. So his character isn't about, no one believes me, I'm saying this thing and no one believes me, and that terrorists are everywhere, which would work because they're his neighbours and no one would believe him and all the rest of it. But the character is about nuance and trying to see the full picture and get all the facts before you make a decision. And like exactly like you say, that is not what we do as the audience. We just, we think we're on one narrative track and we're not. That's why it's so good.
Beautiful. Okay, let's talk about the film. And we'll kick off with a scene that the director on the commentary calls, he calls the opening of the film The Bloody Child. So we're in the suburbs of Washington and there is a kid stumbling down the street. And our hero, Jeff Bridges, playing Michael Faraday, finds him. And it's all kind of out of focus. And
it's like a war movie. That's what it's like. It's like the fog of war because of the tinnitus and the you can't see what he's doing. He's been in a war, that kid, which works later.
And Paddington says it's slightly frustrating because watching it in a cinema with an audience, everyone's shouting out that the focus isn't working on the film.
Really?
Yeah, the screenings he went to. Yeah.
I thought it was going to be a dream sequence because it's shot like a dream sequence as well.
I thought it might be a memory. The first
that's sorry, that's yeah. what I mean. Like he was flashing back to something yeah. and then Jeff Bridges was going to wake up and go,
yeah.
It's all very disorienting and we realise the child has most of his hand missing. And it grabs you, doesn't it? It grabs you by the proverbials.
So I alluded to this in my intro on Monday.
You did. Which, I nearly called you out on it.
Which is, my question is, has Tim Robbins, have Tim Robbins and John Cusack, is it?
Yeah.
Have they done this to their son on purpose, assuming he is their son, as a way of luring Faraday into their lives?
I wonder. If he isn't their son, which is something we'll talk about later, it would be cool as fuck if he wasn't their son, then yes. If he is their son, maybe not, because they are a wholesome family in their own weird way. But they've been looking, in my head, they were looking for something to get Jeff Bridges' attention. This accident happens, and they're like, well, that'll do. So they send him off down the street, but they're kind of there waiting just in case he doesn't take him to hospital, maybe.
Right.
That's what I think.
How do they know he's going to come around the corner at that time?
Because they're watching him. They know every movement.
Yeah, of course. They've probably got spotters out on the route. I there's a part of me, and I think it really works with just how, I think it really works with understanding just how the conviction and the belief of Tim Robbins and what he wants to do, that that they've done this on purpose to the child, possibly their own son, to get Jeff Bridges involved. I think it makes you go, that's conviction.
Because if he is their son, he later on, and you do believe him, he's like, this is a war and children die in a war. And you think, oh, okay, so does that mean you would sacrifice your own child? But you probably would because you believe this so much. So blowing his hand off would be nothing to you.
I'm still not sure. I kind of wish that this film had made it explicit one way or the other. And in the commentary, it's Paddington Bridges. They don't say that at all. They don't go down that route in terms of that opening scene being something that's been set up.
I mean, the only reason to go it was just an accident is the idea that Jeff Bridges does at one point sort of become a little bit interested in like fireworks. Don't do that. Like that's an explosive that's done there, which is almost sort of like giving him, you know, evidence that they might be up to something very early on.
Because they also established that it's not Halloween. So why would
that? Sorry,
fireworks?
That's the line. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So then we're into the opening credits, which I wrote down. Feels like Seven has been an influence on these opening credits.
Unbelievable.
And then on the commentary they said, yeah, we got the guy who did the Seven opening credits to do this.
It's so
he
crazy.
He gets around, doesn't he?
Yeah, we talked about him the other day.
Minority Report.
Yeah, I think he just had a good sort good of 90s run into the 2000s. But yeah, I mean, it's cool. It sets up little things like surveillance and, you know, it's sort of suggesting that there's some danger lurking in suburbia. So
I don't know. They've dated. Like, I will say, if this of everything in this film, that's the only bit that makes me go, I'm watching a movie from the late 90s.
Yeah. But then we meet the Langs for the first time, played, as you said, by Tim Robbins and Joan Cusack. And they're in shadow the first time we see them. They're in darkness. The film is telling us right from the opening scene that they're villains. But obviously, you're not probably going to catch that the first time you watch it. And yeah, as you say, he blames it. The dad blames it on a super rocket. But again, it's so brilliant watching it the second time. That's why I was excited, because I'd only seen it once before. And it's one of those films you think, yeah, I can't wait to... I will watch that again one day because... Yeah. it'll be a different viewing. And he feels, Oliver Lang feels so insincere here. Like, you can tell he's more worried about getting caught than he is about his son being hurt. So,
because again, you know, I always say too much detail. When you lie, you say too much because you want to seem sincere. So he overdoes it about, oh, and he's in the park and doing this. And if that had really happened to you, you wouldn't say anything.
You're right. Yeah, yeah.
I learned that because when I used to
lie.
genuinely, when I didn't want to do something on text and I'd committed to something, I'd write a massive essay about why I couldn't do it and how sorry I was. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that is exactly when I received those messages, I'm like, bullshit. Mm-hmm. So now I'm just like, yeah, I can't make it. Which is rude, but actually seems like sincere.
Yeah.
Even though it's a lie.
Oh. I look forward to getting one of those long emails from you maybe one day. And then we get some backstory for our characters. So we learn that the Langs have lived in that street for 2 months. Oliver Lang grew up on a farm in Kansas. He went to university there. And he's now a structural engineer working on the local mall. Mm. That's his story, and he's sticking to it. And as for Michael, his wife died 2 years previous. For her country. She was an FBI agent and she was killed in the line of duty.
That flashback's horrible, where she dies.
Yeah.
We're not there yet, though. We are not there, Alex. He now teaches American terrorism in quite intense fashion.
Sure. It is a bit much.
A bit. He fucking...
When he grabs that girl, he's like, what do you think about something? She's like, I don't fucking know.
He frightens her. But yeah, he's describing the Oklahoma City bombing and a bit about being, you know, the news saying it was one man and the police saying it was one man, no conspirators. He's not buying it. But America was safe again as far as we were concerned. And that's what we needed to hear, apparently. We need someone to blame. We need one name. We need it fast.
So it seemed like a real... Are teachers allowed to do that? Is it not like, oh, I'm saying... You know, he literally goes, they're lying.
Yeah, I think you're supposed to present the facts.
But yeah, he says we need one name, one person to give us our security back. So he's essentially setting out the ending and describing his own demise in this opening schoolroom scene, which is beautifully written. So now we sort of get some clues as to what's going on. Michael starts smelling a rat. Or we do, like, it's a bit weird when the kids are playing and it's a soldier's compound they've created and the Lang's son is talking about classified information. He's talking like a soldier. And you're like, you just start thinking, this is the stuff that's slightly off. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it, Michael's seeing it. And then the letter shows up from University of Pennsylvania. Oliver's told us he went to the University of Kansas.
Now, this is intentional. This is the Langs doing this on purpose.
I think so.
Right.
I think that now, but I have seen it 1,000 times, but I still think that watching it fresh. Like, okay.
They need him to start investigating them, I guess. He catches a look at the mall blueprint, and it's not a mall, it's an office blueprint. Again, these people are too clever. They wouldn't just leave that lying around while taking a phone call.
So later on, it's only a small thing, but like when he finds the blueprint hidden behind the St. Louis Arch, if you really were hiding something from someone, you wouldn't hide it behind another picture. He's done it on purpose, so it looks hidden.
Yeah.
And in your sort of panicked mind, it looks well enough hidden that you weren't supposed to find it, but obviously you wouldn't ever put it there.
No.
It's a stupid place to put something.
And we have this dinner party where we sort of fade in and fade out of the couple's conversations.
That was really, really well done. I loved that. Mm. Like, really theatrical. I thought it was brilliant.
And I think that all came out of their improvisation, where he'd written one scene, Erin Kruger, but when they got together, they kind of figured out a more interesting way of, I guess, the Langs feeling Faraday out, or they're not feeling out because they've already made the decision, I guess, but they're... they're seeding little ideas.
But they're trying to find out how easy it's going to be for them. Because if they say, what do you think? Do you think we should blow the government up? I'm like, God, fuck yeah, I do actually. Like, great. Like, join the party.
What does he say? You can expect the government to be accountable.
Yes. Yeah. So Oliver wants to put politicians in jail, whereas Michael says he just wants them to be accountable and he wants someone to admit they made a mistake regarding his wife's death.
Did you notice Tim Robbins was drinking milk as well?
No.
I did. So
that is wholesome.
That's wholesome. So again, in the same scene, you're like, but he's a good person because he's not drinking booze.
But then I think we get one of the creepiest scenes in the film, which I didn't appreciate as much until I actually watched it with the commentary on, where Jeff Bridges was talking about it, where they're at the batting cage.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you said that. This is the one I want to talk about.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
You say what you've got to say.
So Oliver is bonding with Michael's son, and the words I write down is sort of, there's self-righteousness to him and there's sort of a friendly menace is how I describe the way Robbins is acting. Bridges says that what they're trying to do here is Oliver's preying on his feelings of inadequacy as a father.
Yes, of course.
And he's trying to trigger something that sparks a fire in Michael to really not sort of start this investigation
proper. Because then you've let your child down.
Well, and also he's sowing the seeds for later on where he chases the van, or the van that he thinks is the van, into the building because he thinks his son is in the back. So
Of course, okay, cool. I think it's and if the other, on the other level, is Oliver up to something or not? So when he's saying to Michael, oh, Grant opened up about his dead mum, and he says, oh, he wants someone to pay. So it's kind of like, why would you not want that? So you, I thought, you know, on one of the many times I've watched this, oh, Grant wouldn't say that. So you're being groomed, Michael Faraday. There's no way your son has said that to that man. So you're thinking that in the scene, you think he's clearly lying. He's grooming you to do something that you wouldn't ordinarily otherwise do. But then you see Brady, which is Tim Robbins' kid, and he's sat on the bench and he's looking sad. So you think in the same moment, are you sad because your dad never talks to you? So therefore, Tim Robbins is lying. He doesn't open up to kids. He doesn't bond with kids at all. So you're sitting there looking left out because the scene is saying, the direction is saying, that man is a liar. He doesn't talk to children because look at his own son. His own son is a bit of a mess. Or is his own son jealous because he can hear him and Tim Robbins is telling the truth because Grant did open up to him and Brady's feeling pushed out.
Brilliant. Oh, I thought it was also potentially because he can't play baseball because he's lost his fingers in an explosion that his dad made him do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and that's so true,
And therefore, he's sort of like regretting that because now the dad's with someone else. So he made that sacrifice for his dad, who is now having fun with another kid.
Yeah, that's true. Brilliant.
A lot going on.
A lot.
In a little scene that I didn't really pay any attention to the first time I watched it. And so, yeah, that investigation, then it becomes clear that Oliver really didn't go to Kansas University. He went to Penn State and his real name is William Fenimore. Then we've got a section I'm calling Fucked Up Field Trip because Michael takes his school to Copper Creek where his wife was killed and he describes to his students how his wife was killed. Yeah. This does not seem professional
to
me.
HR red flag, I think, at best.
Yeah, he gets incredibly amped up as he's telling the stories. And as Alex said, we get this flashback. So we see, and it is horrific. The FBI thought they were uncovering this terrorist plot, but really it was a bloke who was going to sell some guns.
I mean, I think to me as a UK viewer, it didn't quite work. It didn't quite have the punch that it should have done because he's saying the FBI got it wrong. These flags should not have gone up. This man had a legacy gift or something and he could afford them. And he just intended to sell them. But it's like, to me, like, you were still stockpiling weapons. Like, it doesn't matter to me from the UK if you were going to sell them or not. That, to me, still seems quite a threatening thing to do. Because if someone did that here, that would be legitimately terrifying. So it didn't quite work for me the first time around.
But he wasn't doing anything illegal.
No. Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think what really hits me is the pointlessness of her death. The fact that it was just a stupid mistake.
An admin error, yeah.
And she loses her life for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so weird decision from Michael Faraday here. And then he agrees to let his son go off to scout. And what I like in this scene where he packs the boy off is that wave that Oliver gives him because it's half a Nazi salute.
Yeah.
Sort of seeding, you know. That there's
some... it's like Nazi youth camp.
Yeah. And there's white nationalism, you know, just bubbling under the surface.
Maybe a little bit on the nose when the kids are like reciting the thing and they're like, we pledge allegiance to, and it's like a little bit blunt. It's like, clearly you are Nazi youth, but fine. It's fine.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few things that are clunky in it, but equally I sort of forgive the film for them because it's just, I just love the way it's all so neatly, the setup and payoff I think works so well all the way through. Now I'm doing a section called A Tale of Three Jump Scares.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure if three is too many, but we get three in a row.
Yeah.
So the first one is when our boy Michael talks his way into the Lang's house. I like little Daphne's face, the little girl.
She's so scary.
Awful.
And he's snooping around the study and he gets, you know, gets a look at a blueprint under a blueprint, and then he gets caught in the act because Joan Cusack walks in on him. Jump scare one. Frightening.
Yeah.
Good jump scare. Next thing you know, he's in a microfilm reading room and he's doing more. Essentially, we're watching a guy Googling, aren't we? But he's more investigating. He's figured out that Oliver tried to pipe bomb a mailroom when he was 16 years old. And then jump scare two, Oliver walks in on him.
Mm-hmm.
You've just done the same. You've just done twice.
Mm-hmm.
And he should blatantly go for a drink with him when he's like, I just swung by to go for a drink. He should be like, oh yeah, great idea. Like, you look so suspicious.
He did,
like, go away.
He did. He's not very good at this. Little break before we get to jump scare three. In fact, we'll have an actual break.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, and we're back. We've got a scene in Michael's garden where Michael is sleeping with the yearbook open on the page. Tim Robbins' character, and would you just fall asleep with this frightening thing in front of you? But Oliver walks in on him and has a massive go at him. One thing I like here is you can see his Christian cross. They're making a real point that he's a Christian here. But he starts explaining. Oliver starts sort of fighting back, saying, "My dad killed himself because the government took his water. He realized he was worth more dead than alive." And I think Tim Robbins is a bit over the top in this scene, but it's enough to throw us off balance. Definitely. In the way that it throws Michael off balance.
And he's telling the truth here, is he?
I think so, because the microfilm is a real clipping of him being caught having tried to blow something up.
And Pellington wrote this, the fact that the father had committed suicide, because he wanted to give Oliver a false sense of sympathy, wanted us to briefly feel some sympathy for this guy.
Yeah, because you have to believe him at that point in the film, otherwise it's a different kind of film.
But also, it's just a great way of him turning the table. So suddenly Michael feels guilty and he feels like he's the villain now.
Yeah.
Sorry, you said, was that a mistake when you said Pellington wrote this, or did Pellington add this scene in?
Yeah, Pellington add this scene in. Yeah, it was his idea to have this as this suicide backstory.
Wow.
It all gets a bit Hitchcockian now. Brooke, who is, well, I've not really mentioned her, played by Hope Davis, and Michael's girlfriend, she... one of these convenient moments, she's in a car park and Oliver's in the same car park.
Yeah, but previous to this, I think there's that weird moment where Michael is sort of talking about Tim Robbins Oliver, and he's like going, "I don't trust them," to Brooke, "I think there's something going on." And she immediately goes, "Did you do this to me before we started dating?"
Yeah.
Which is such a shitty thing to say.
Yeah.
I thought that made her character, because she goes on to sort of like obviously have a big switcheroo and go, "Actually, there's something going on here." But in that moment, it makes her quite unlikable, because you are very much like, yeah, finally Michael is, you know, realizes something going on like we have. Mm. And then she sort of makes it about her. And it does.
Yeah, you need someone to be the voice of reason to question Michael. You need that character. But as you say, maybe that wasn't, she comes on too strong too soon, maybe.
She should have said, because her arc should be about the she can't replace the dead wife, because that's clear. And that's a little bit there. Mm. So it should be something like, stop trying to be your wife. Like, stop trying to investigate everybody, because I'm here now and she's not. Yeah. And that's that.
Nice one, Vicky. That can be your change.
Yeah,
Brooke sees Oliver doing some kind of exchange with a woman in a car park.
And you think this is intentional?
Getting into a different car. Because we're getting to jump scare three.
Okay.
Brooke follows him to the Liberty Delivery Service. Bit on the nose, that. Liberty Delivery Service. Where something's going on with this delivery service. And so she drives to a payphone. She phones and leaves an answer machine message on Michael's answer machine. And then we get jump scare three. the best jump scare.
Yeah. Mm.
Cheryl standing behind her.
Yeah. Great.
Joe Cusack. But as I have to say, I'm just a bit annoyed that they did three in a row. I don't think you're allowed to do that.
Well, not just three jump scares in a row, three of exactly the same jump scare. Somebody's behind you.
Yeah. So for Cheryl to be there, though, I'm guessing she must have been following Brooke, who was following Oliver. Because how is she just suddenly there?
Exactly. Mm.
Sharping.
The look on her face, which is like, I'm going to have to kill you. And I don't want to, but I will.
Well, it's a smile that fades, isn't
it?
You see the light go out of her eyes.
Yeah.
And yeah, next thing we know, Cheryl's dead in a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, this scene made me laugh, actually.
Brooke is dead in a car crash.
Brooke is dead in a car crash. Sorry, there's too many names. Oliver and Cheryl are then comforting Michael. And that made me laugh because it was so dark. Them saying, we're here for you.
Yeah, we're really here for you.
I mean, it's funny, but it's dark.
But it is. I think at that point, it's so dark, it's funny. I certainly think it's crossed the line into like, this is black comedy now.
So they've pretty much broken Michael here and he's giving up the investigation. But then we realise that there's been some switcheroo with the answer machine message and he realises that Brooke had left him a message and it's not there anymore. So now he's on a mission. He's on a mission to figure out what's going on. And he does figure out that there's something going on. That, you know, this has all been a conspiracy. They've done it before, a previous bombing, someone was set up. So he's figured it out, basically. And he realises his son's in danger. Mm. So he goes to get his son. But Oliver has taken his son home. So he goes over to Oliver's house and that's when he walks in on a party that they're having.
Yeah, it's weird this.
Why are they having a party?
I don't know. I suppose it was, in my head, it's to celebrate the fact that their plan is going really well.
I think it's, you know, when you go out on Christmas Eve before Christmas Day, it's like that.
I tell you what it is. This is what it is. This essay must be coming back to me. They need people to say to the press when it's all gone wrong for Michael, he actually gatecrashed the party about 2 days ago and he did seem really unhinged. Yeah. And you need as many witnesses as possible.
But aren't most of those guests in on the plan? Like,
yeah, that's the point. So it's orchestrated.
Oh, okay,
the whole
thing.
They know he's going to go and find his son. His son's not there. So you have a big public event.
Yep.
So that then you can go to the press and be like, he blundered through this party and he looked deranged.
What did you get for this essay? It's pretty good.
Yeah, I wonder. I have no idea. But then also, excuse me, sorry, I'm speaking really quickly because I love this film. Tim Robbins also says to him, it'll all be over in a couple of days. Because I always wondered, you know, when you're watching it the first few times, is he going to give him his son back? If he just keeps quiet and doesn't do anything, will it actually be fine? No, because it'll all be over in a couple of days means you won't be with us in a couple of days. I think.
I thought this party scene was a bit like the party scene in Cable Guy.
I totally agree.
The way they shot it, the Dutch angles. And interestingly, just like I listened to the Ben Stiller commentary on that, the Mark Pennington commentary here, they both said this scene was inspired by Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
So, and that chilling line as well, he says to her, Brooke got in the way, we're on a schedule. So it's so matter of fact, it's just business now.
Mm. It was a bit Eyes Wide Shut for me when Tom Cruise is at the masked orgy. Obviously with less sex.
Less masks.
Yeah, less masks as well.
So similar in lots of ways.
If you take
there's people in a room.
You know what it's more like? And I think Ben Stiller would say the same thing about the Cable Guy. More like Rosemary's Baby.
And then the film literally fades out to darkness and then fades back up. And on the commentary, Penn says, this is the fade into Act 3.
Okay.
He literally did it. He literally made it fade out and in. So Bridges is looking pretty dishevelled now. He's panicked and he sees the van with his boy in the back.
Yeah.
And we get the dolly zoom, that reverse tracking shot that we love from Jaws and Hitchcock. And we get this moment where he's chasing the van down and then Oliver manages to crash into him.
Yep.
And they have a punch up. I mean, it's got to be very well coordinated to get that all to work.
In the car. Yeah, but it does.
But yeah, so they have a fight and, you know, we're feeling like we're watching our guy get the upper hand on Oliver, which is quite satisfying. You want to see Oliver get punched. You want to see him get him told off or, you know, told he's a shit. it seems like he's giving a confession, which is what we want to hear. But obviously, in hindsight, we realise this is just a delaying tactic. But Michael's off to save the day and we're fully behind him now, even though as he's driving away, Pennington does a close-up on his boot to make us look at his boot.
Okay.
Because, spoiler alert, there's now a bomb in his boot, but we don't know that at the time. But he's telling us because it's good directing, man. He's having a laugh. His phone's breaking up. That's convenient when he's trying to tell the FBI what's going on.
Yeah.
But it feels like almost like Liam Neeson in Taken. It's that kind of sequence where, you know, it's following action movie tropes and we're getting excited because we know how this is going to end, but we don't because we're being tricked And as I said, Michael's seeing what he wants to see and we're seeing what we want to see. So, yeah, he gets to the car park. What do you think of this scene then?
This is so stressful. Like, everything he's just done, they knew, you know, what you would do to save your child in that situation. And, you know, I just watched Prisoners and it's like, fucking hell. So all this is like circling around, like the things that people will do. Mm. And so he's broken quite a few rules that would have been important to him. Like he's driven past security and all the rest of it. But this is so pedestrian. And that's why it's good that it's just a few men holding him back from a van. He's like, I really need to get to that van. And the idea that people are stopping him after everything he's been through to get into the car park is just too much to even bear. Mm. And then it goes on maybe slightly too late, just like, just let him do it. And then it just builds and builds. Then obviously they pop it open and there's nothing there. And then when you're watching this for the first time, you're just like, what the fuck? Mm. Like, what's going
to
happen?
And that line, the only person who isn't meant to be here is you. That gives me goosebumps. It's just wow. And then obviously.
So when did you realise what was going on, do you think, first time you watched
not until
it?
Not until
he opened the boot. And even then, it was only when it explodes that I was like, they're not going to find a way out of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't believe that was the end. It's only when, like, you realise, I think it took me until after that, I was like, well, they probably survived the explosion or something, and then he's going to come back and get Tim Robbins and get himself. My brain just didn't work on the basis that the end was a win for Tim Robbins. I still don't know. I think I love it, but it just feels like it's from a sort of a 90s popcorn action movie where Tim Robbins stands on the roof and goes, boom.
It's a little bit much.
I get it for his character because obviously he's excited about this and he wants to see the explosion, that like the bomb go off. But I don't know whether you'd say boom.
Yeah, you're right.
It's very John Travolta in Broken Arrow is what it is.
And then we cut to the news. So the explosions happen. We cut to the news over the next few days. And they start believing it's the work of Michael Faraday. It's connected to the death of his wife. Mm. And as that news gets fainter and fainter, as we all sort of lose interest, they get away with it. But yeah, they say his behaviour was increasingly erratic. They describe that Copper Creek visit. You know, and then there's a girl who was in his class.
She was part of it.
And she was there right from the beginning in his car. She's at Copper Creek. She's the one who's involved. She's at a payphone, isn't she, a bit later on. And she's the one who says to camera that Michael said to her, sweetheart, one day those men are going to pay. One day those men are going to burn. And she kind of does almost a little smile. And yeah, that's it. It was the work of one man and one man alone. And we cut to Oliver and his family who are moving on to somewhere new.
Yeah. And poor Grant.
Oh, it's so awful.
Mum's dead, dad's dead, and a massive criminal in the eyes of everyone. And
I think about it all the time. So he's off in the care of relatives and he looks sad and he's a child actor and he's doing a good sad face. But maybe I'm projecting, is there a bit where he doesn't quite believe it? And so the cycle starts again because he's like, my dad, some things don't add up about that day.
Victoria, would you like to know about the closed eye version of the ending?
Yeah.
So they shot this. You can watch it. It's on the Blu-ray. But they thought it might make the ending more palatable if the son realises what's happened and sees the truth.
Okay.
So there's a scene early on where I think his mum, a flashback to his mum telling him that when he's not sure about someone telling the truth or not, he should close his eyes and listen to his heart. And so
does he just close his eyes in the car?
So later in the film, we're in the house, Oliver sits him down and tells him, look, your dad was a hero, and says a bunch of nice things about his dad. He's the bravest man I've ever known because he believed in something. And while he's saying that, Oliver's closing his eyes because we know what he's doing. He's figuring out he's not believing this guy. And then he also, the scene where Oliver is burning those photos, he sees that as well.
Yeah.
So the kid knows. And as he drives away with the family, he turns back and he glares at them.
Yeah.
Because he knows. And so that ending is almost like, well, maybe good ultimately will win. Or maybe the cycle starts again.
Yeah.
Or maybe he will eventually be able to expose them. And it's a really good ending. The scenes really work. But the director said it felt like we were dragging it out. The ending, because it's like four endings then pretty much. And also it created this confusion and ambiguity in that audience was coming out saying, well, when's the sequel?
Yeah. Mm.
And that's not what they wanted to make. They didn't want to make a film that people wanted to see a sequel
to. Yeah.
And so to make it more clear and concise, they just cut it all out. But it's a really compelling couple of scenes and very upsetting as well.
Mm.
But yeah, the ending was a bone of contention for everyone. Tim Robbins said that he had mixed feelings about it.
In what respect?
About concluding on a downbeat. He says that there was a meeting among the cast and crew to discuss whether the finale should be scrapped for something a little cheerier. He said it's a discussion that had to be had even though no changes were made. So they got cold feet, clearly, while they were making the film, that this just goes too far. But mercifully, they didn't change their minds.
It is so bleak, though. It's not a movie I'm ever going to watch again, I can tell you that.
But the big problem...
I think it makes you kind of weird that you've watched it so many times.
I don't know what it's done to me.
But
between Chris's intro and you loving this film...
I'm feeling a bit nervous.
I feel like the only sane one here, which is rare.
But Bridges recorded this commentary before the film came out, and it was the first time he'd seen it was while he was doing the commentary. And you can tell he's just enraged because the trailer gives away that Tim Robbins is the villain.
Really?
And so he said, yeah, it's got scenes of Robin slamming him against a wall and Robin's kidnapping his son. And so he felt like there was no tension there. And even when these cool scenes are happening, reveals, Bridges is just going, yeah, well, the audience already knows. People already know. So
Fuck it. They already know, don't they? Fucking movie.
He believed the trailer should have set him up as the villain rather than a potential villain, rather than Robin's, just to make it more interesting for the audience. And it was released not long after Columbine. It was pushed back a couple of times. So I think the audience, the studio was a little bit frightened. I don't think this got the promotion it probably should have got.
No, when I watched it, it felt like a movie that I picked off the shelf and went, oh my God, Tim Robbins, Jeff Bridges. I haven't heard about this. I'm going to watch it.
It made $41 million from a $31 million budget, which isn't great. But, you know, it's a prescient, important film, I think. In July 1999, talking to Entertainment Weekly about the film, Robbins talked about the fact that they were trying to document what was happening. He said, there are fundamentalists everywhere throughout the world, whether they're Islamic or Christian. There are those who believe God is telling them to commit violence, and I take them very seriously. And as I say, that was July 1999. Mm-hmm. So we all know what happened a couple of years later. So, yeah, that's about it. As Alex said, we might have a TV series coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your lot.
Amazing.
Any more for any more?
Good for me.
Okay. Vicky. Best scene.
The ending.
Okay. It's good. Alex,
the ending.
Scene. Okay.
Also, though, like as a very, very close second is Joan Cusack's face when she goes, sharping. And Brooke goes, what are you doing here? I'm sharping. You're going to die. I'm going to kill you. Sharping.
That's what I've got.
Really?
That's what I've got. But just to switch things up, so we do three different ones. I think the opening sequence, I think, is fantastic as well, but not as good as the ending or Joan Cusack's face. Most valuable ever, Alex.
Tim Robbins. I think he's just incredible here. He's so horrible and so good at being horrible. And you just really get, like, throughout, you just get this guy's conviction that he is right and what he's doing is right. And the calm that he has, like the way he's never like you never feel like he's got the upper hand or like, but he does. Anyway, it's Tim Robbins.
Vicky?
The ending. And I don't care what you think about that. That's what I'm picking, because without the ending, I don't think we would still be talking about this film at all. Really? And it's why people like me still really love it. And just the minute that Grant pops up in that van, the way that the stress of the situation is written and directed and acted and all of it and the music and everything, it's unreal, unreal. And you just have a minute to recover when he opens the van and there's nothing in there. And then your brain is just scrambled. And then maybe a beat too late, but then the whole thing goes up and that is just, that's everything.
That's why I picked it as my best scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is where should go.
Yeah.
I'm going for Erin Kruger because I love this film as much as I hate his Transformers movies.
Idiot. They're great.
No, I don't like the ones he wrote.
He does the best three. He does Revenge of the Fallen, Dark of the Moon, and Age of Extinction. I'm only half lying. Carry on.
There's some stuff that's way too convenient on a second watch and relies too much on coincidence, in my opinion, but it just packs such a punch that I think it's a brilliant script. change, what would you change, Vicky?
So Oliver and Cheryl, Tim Robbins and Joan Cusack, aren't even fucking married. They're colleagues. So when they're at the end and they're watching Michael's house and it's all boarded up and the where next, it then becomes really clear that they're working together. They're not in a romantic or sexual relationship. So then they're, you know, and the kid's been recruited as well, which is really dark because where did he come from? And then they're on to the next one. So either that, or if that's too...
You mean Grant has been recruited? Jeff Bridges' kid.
No, sorry, Brady.
Right.
Brady, that's what I meant. Or maybe let's find out a bit more about Cheryl. So say she is Tim Robbins' actual wife and she actually loves him and sleeps with him and all the rest of it. He does such a good job of having a reason for why he is the way he is and they stole his daddy's land and all the rest of it. But why is she involved? Like, she does kill an innocent woman and just being married to the man who feels like that is not enough. So he gets a big full backstory about why he's the way he is and she doesn't. So maybe we could do that.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Alex.
Jeff Bridges is... I know he's meant to be angry at the government and demanding answers. I do think he's great in it. But he's like, his character is very unlikable. And I do sometimes watch it. Well, on the second watch of it, I was just... If he was a bit more likable, if you had more sympathy for him, and so... Like, he was sort of aware of his anger. For example, when he's giving the lecture at the start and he, like, gets in that girl's face and then he sort of withdraws and goes, like, I'm sorry. And, you know, and you sort of get that he's struggling with these demons in a way where he's sort of a little bit like, you know, I'm aware that I'm being too much and too intense. And that created this likability that you sort of sympathize with him more. His anger and his intensity, you know, I think makes him a little bit like, oh, God, I wouldn't want to be around him. And for that reason, and I'm not saying it's right, it's just what I thought on this watch. For that reason, I just think if he was more likable, it would actually have an be even more impactful at the end when the good guy loses.
Mm.
I don't find him a very likable presence in this movie, is the short answer. And I wonder if that... that dampens what is already a huge ending.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because when you meet Joe Cusack at the party, when Brooke and Michael Faraday go over and the kids are playing together and Brady's hand is a little bit better and stuff like that, and she's saying, oh, how did you meet? And Brooke has obviously rehearsed this line, like, oh, I was his teaching assistant. And you are meant to think, that's a bit of a dick thing that you did there.
Yeah.
And Joan Cusack's face is like, oh, really? Like, yuck, kind of thing. Like, you replaced your dead wife with someone that worked for you who we're meant to think is quite a bit younger than you. And it's all a little bit murky because you were her boss.
I think the most pronounced thing for me at the end is when Grant's going off with relatives. And I did think, he'd probably have a better time with them than he would with his dad, who doesn't seem to have much time for him and is quite abrupt with him.
Oh, it is heartbreaking, though, when he tells him he can't go to camp and the kid is just going nuts. Like, you said you would let me. And he's like, but I can't. And I've really felt sorry for him because he said he could go and now you can't go, but I can't tell you why. And you just have to listen to me. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
And we didn't say it, but the child actors are good in this film as well. You've got the kid from Unbreakable and you've got Dennis the Menace. And they both do a really, really good job, I think, with the, you know, they're only in it briefly, but yeah. I think they're both excellent. I sort of said this already. But I think I got annoyed by that trailer. I saw that trailer and I did feel like it gave too much away when I went into this film. I wish I'd gone into this film not knowing anything. So
I thought you didn't watch trailers.
Not these days, but okay. In 1999.
Is this the movie that helped you learn that lesson?
No, in all honesty, it was having to go through trailers with a fine tooth comb to write these features around them. That did my head in, to be honest. I'd never want to see another trailer. But yeah, so I'm with Jeff Bridges on this. They should have cut a trailer that didn't give away the ending. I think the film might have done better. And that's it.
Right then, The Burbs versus Arlington Road. It's time for the verdict.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
Victoria, your choices.
Yeah. What a day.
Mm?
2 days.
Mm?
Sorry. Right, you go first, Alex.
So I think the ending of Arlington Road, as we've just discussed, is genuinely one of the most memorable endings that I've ever seen in a movie ever. Mm. And it's fantastic. And I certainly remembered it walking into this viewing while I didn't remember a single other frame of that movie, which, you know, arguably, like, that ending deserves its place as the winner this week alone. But I find it strange that the rest of the movie just sort of washed over me. And I, even talking about it today, I'm like, oh, yeah, that bit. Oh, yeah, that bit. And whether that's because I knew the ending was coming, so I was just waiting for that moment. The Burbs, on the other hand, is, so, you know, Nostalgia's a weird thing, and I did watch it.
We're saying that a lot on this podcast.
I did watch it again this time, and it, you know, I think so much falls flat. There's some really rubbish slapstick moments in there. You know, it's like, are you intentionally doing the Three Stooges, or are you just doing a guy whose hose isn't long enough to reach his friend? I'm not sure. But there's something about the atmosphere that that movie creates that is just like so off kilter that I really love. So it's a very tough week is what I'm saying, Victoria. But my answer for which of these movies is getting my vote this week is going to The Burbs. Yeah, it's the movie I will be watching again where I will never watch Arlington Road again.
I find that personally offensive given how many times I've watched it.
That's why I said it.
What about you?
I just do not get The Burbs, okay. So I'm not going to drag this out. But I don't find it funny. I think it's quite boring, and I think they really, really fumble the ending. If they'd figured out how to end that movie, I think I might like it a bit more. But as it stands, it just makes me shrug. I'm like, oh well, whatever. There's nothing there for me to grab onto. I think Arlington Road is fantastic. Absolutely delivers, and I think it also, what adds to it is it genuinely has something to say about the media and about domestic terrorism, about and where America was at the time. And it looks like a really important film 20 years later, to be honest. So, yeah, it's no contest this week. Arlington Road.
Okay, so it's one each, which means it comes back to you as it should. These were your choices. I've written down what I think you're going to go for.
Really?
I saw him doing it.
Yeah. Really? I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to go for. But, you know, in theory, from everything you said, this is a close one for you,
this
right?
This has never been closer.
Oh, wow.
I can't decide.
Okay.
So I haven't decided. So this is going to be a bit even more rambling than usual. So the weirdness of The Burbs, it feels like really personal. Like it was written for me, like all that sort of...
You're really nervous about this decision. You're wrapping a wire like a tourniquet around your arm.
That was disturbing, wasn't it? Why did you stop her? She might have passed out.
I'm sorry.
How tense are you?
Just don't want to get it wrong. Sorry, that's so weird.
I don't want to get my opinion wrong.
I don't want to get my own opinion wrong, do I? You know what I'm like. I can't be getting that wrong. Where was I? So yeah, and it is a duvet movie and all of that. And I do genuinely, I just love it. I love it like it's a person. But then Arlington Road, just talking about it now, like I could talk about it all day, and I have seen it dozens of times, and I still want to talk about it, and I still want to watch it, and I will watch it again. So here we go. Here is the reason, and this breaks my heart to do this, but that's what this show is all about. So
we're here to break hearts.
So it's a tiny, tiny thing. The conveniences in Arlington Road, Tim Robbins popping up and John Cusack popping up, I believe are there on purpose. And there's one massive convenience at the end of The Burbs, which is the Klopex call the police because they know that Tom Hanks has broken into their house. If they've been burning bodies, they wouldn't call the police. That's the only reason I can come up with. So I pick in Arlington Road.
Called it.
No!
Yeah, I knew you'd pick it. I had a feeling. It feels like the movie that you're going to pick.
But it's that petty a decision. You know, there's nothing... I know they're completely different films, apart from the overarching Neighbours thing, but...
It's also better.
I mean, I don't see that. I do. I mean, I do and I don't. It's like the nostalgia is a weird thing.
I tend to watch movies. If I'm rewatching a movie, I tend to be in the mood for something that is going to relax me. And Arlington Road will never relax me. Whereas The Burbs, I will watch again and again because of its duvet effect. So
yeah, but I do think as well, like what you said, like where we are, you know, however many years later, the themes of the film, there was a brief moment where it was like in terms of a threat to the US, it was terrorism from overseas. And now we're back where we were in Arlington Road. And that's a very sad state of affairs, but it's still important. So I suppose it kind of wins on that. That's not its fault or doing, but there we are. Mm-hmm. Wow.
You've made your call.
Yeah.
We have a winner this week then. Congratulations to Arlington Road. 1999's Arlington Road. Congratulations, Mark Pellington, Jeff Bridges, Tim Robbins, John Cusack, everyone involved. Just everyone involved. Well done. Big day.
Aaron Kruger.
Sorry, Aaron Kruger as well. Yes. For his brilliant work on the Transformers franchise. I love those films. Right then. So it was Vicky's choices this week. Arlington Road wins. My choices next week. The clue I gave you on Monday was Till Death Don't Us Part.
Till Death Us Don't Part. No, don't.
Let's
you're right.
Do that again.
You're right. I'm just messing with you.
Right. I haven't asked which you want. Chris, just because you're nearer. Which one do you want?
I think I'll take the first one. If if unless Vicky's got a preference.
No, I don't.
As in chronologically?
Yeah.
Right, okay, which means, Chris, you are taking the Julia Roberts vehicle, Sleeping with the Enemy, whereas Vicky is in the company of Ashley Judd in Double Jeopardy.
Wow.
Sleeping with the Enemy versus Double Jeopardy is
our pairing. This is going to be fun.
Amazing.
This is going to be fun.
I've already seen Double Jeopardy. Oh. Oh, yeah. Right then. So that is your homework for the weekend, Sleeping with the Enemy and Double Jeopardy. Oh, I did look this up. Sleeping with the Enemy is available on Apple.
They're both available to rent on Sky Store.
And if you don't have Sky, then Sleeping with the Enemy is available to rent for £3.49, I believe, on Apple. And Double Jeopardy is available on Amazon and a fair few other places. So... I think actually, is it on Amazon or is it on
Alex?
No, there's an important thing to say. Well, it's either on Amazon or YouTube.
Right. You're right.
It's on Amazon or YouTube. Basically, they're
you
available.
You said it was on Apple, I think, didn't you?
No, that's Sleeping with the Enemy.
Okay.
Anyway, they're available to rent all over the place, apart from Sleeping with the Enemy. It's just an Apple. Good. If you haven't already, please subscribe on Apple, where we definitely are, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. Congratulations, Arlington Road. Back on Monday talking Sleeping with the Enemy. Bye bye.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.